we're all gonna have, you know, AR lenses in our eyes eventually. I really wish I had a co-founder or even co-founders, which is usually how you should, you know, you should start such a complex business. I advise now other companies to really do their due diligence on their ideal investor profile. And in the US, especially in Silicon Valley, it's really tough. People just jump companies every year, every couple of years. And that can kill a startup. I've done so many investor meetings that I wish the companies after me, maybe the companies I will create or other people create, every time they go to a pitch, there should be a high degree of certainty the answer will be yes on the other side. The actual product needs to be perfect. Yeah, there is no perfection, you know, in real world, but it needs to be close to perfect in a way to hopefully create this magic for the customers. So they, in our case, they don't realize that there is a product. They don't realize that they're doing something. It just works.
Hello, Recursive community, and welcome back to the Recursive podcast here in Sofia today. Our next guest is a hardware engineer who is building the future of security. Vince Gedergiev is the co-founder of the US-Bulgarian company Alcatraz, the hardware as a service startup that offers autonomous access control that uses facial biometrics, 3D sensing, and artificial intelligence. You're going to go into a bit more details of how do you do that. Customers of Alcatraz are governmental institutions, but also Fortune 500 companies. And before becoming an entrepreneur, Vince worked for high-profile companies like Apple and also Nvidia. He holds several engineering degrees from Stanford and the universities of South California and Florida. Vince, I'm very happy that you're here. Welcome to the Recursive podcast.
Thank you for having me.
When we met back then, I was surprised to understand that you moved very, very early on to the States. You were born in Russia. Can you tell me about this travel, about this journey? How did you happen to be in the States in the first place?
Yeah, sure. So where should I start? I was born in Russia 39 years ago. I was never supposed to be connected to computers. My grandma, she used to play the violin in the Russia Philharmonic for 51 years.
Wow.
Ever since its inception. And her dream was that my mom and myself, we go after her steps. Even she called my mom Violina, violin. Mm. That's my mom's name. And I used to play the violin when I was a child for 5 or 6 years. But then my parents bought me my first computer when I was 12. And that's it. I don't think I ever touched a violin after that purchase. And, you know, I've always been excited to not play games on the computer, not just browse, but create things. Maybe create a plugin to make our dial-up connection back then faster, or wire up something and then have some software to speed things up. So very early on, I was excited to bring something to other people so they can use it in their daily lives. And that kind of drove me to kind of think about engineering eventually. My parents always wanted to send me away, but not for good, just for a couple of years, so I can learn English and come back. And when I was 15, 16, I went to the UK a few times. Didn't really click with me to stay there for a longer time. And then coming back to Bulgaria, I chose kind of as a final step to explore the US and go there maybe high school for a few years and then come back. So we chose that I was going to go to Florida through an organization, Euroschool Holidays, that was doing student exchange programs. You know, no actual students are exchanged. There is no one coming back to Bulgaria, but you know, they're sending people or you know, high schoolers into the US and host families. But in the last minute, there was a mix-up. And instead of me going to a host family, I went to a Native American guy who used to have a lot of wolves in his backyard in the middle of the desert in Florida. He believed in many gods. He was trying to teach me about his many gods. And my school was a couple of hours away in the Florida heat during the summer. It wasn't a great experience. So in a few weeks, I was ready to go back home. I really wanted to go back to Ruse. I'm from the English language school in Ruse. I wanted to start the school year with my classmates. It just happened that my kind of a goodbye party was also my birthday on September 5th, back then. And one of my classmates from my calculus class, she organized the whole thing, plus invited her parents. And her parents met me. And they were like, well, Vency, why don't you stay with us? We're going to be your host family. We're going to apply officially to adopt you for those couple years. So you can stay and you can learn English and you can be with us. And there were this perfect Baptist family that you would see in the movies, you know, going to church every Wednesday, every Sunday. You play basketball at church, you go to church, Disney trips. With the rest of the children in the church. It taught me a lot about, you know, American culture and traditions in a very constructive way. Mm-hmm. Family values, love, and it was just great, great. So throughout that time, I stayed with them. It was a good experience, and then my vision was, okay, I'm going to stay a few more years, maybe do my bachelor's in the U.S. Anyway, I applied, they accepted me into a few schools. And, you know, life kind of happens. You stay for something, then you finish the degree, then, oh, I want to do a little more. I started doing my PhD even. Eventually, I decided to switch into master's because I didn't want to spend a lot of time in a lab and just doing research. I thought I was supposed to do something else that's more short term, that will give a product out to people instead of doing something long term that mm-hmm. eventually may have an application in 10 to 20 years. You know, that's how I stayed for a while. And then eventually I graduated, and my first job out of school was at NVIDIA, which is one of the companies that I admired, not because of their GPUs and gaming, but there were those early signs back then in 2010, 2011 of a lot of data to be processed using GPUs and those kind of chipsets. And NVIDIA was right on top with AMD as one of those companies that would really help drive this new category of software hardware development. You know, they were just starting up to think about what if they put their chips not only for games in computers and laptops. They kind of tried it with phones and tablets, but it didn't work out because the chips require a little more power. They're a little hotter than they should be in those really small form factors. So NVIDIA said, well, we want to do it in cars. We want to be the driving chip in vehicles. And back then, and even now, Tesla's factory, and back then in 2011, Tesla was just starting up. Elon just announced the Model S, but you know, he announced a shell of a car that really, like, it was not really functioning, but it had to function at some point. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the factory that Tesla bought from Toyota was just a few miles away from NVIDIA. And that was my first project at NVIDIA. I joined the automotive division, and one of the first chipsets that went into cars was for Tesla Model S. Mm-hmm. You know, Tesla Model S has a big screen and a small screen, so a couple actually two different chipsets from NVIDIA are driving those multimedia systems. And we were tasked to integrate and make it work. Initially, it didn't work at all. Like, you couldn't even turn on the car for over 10 minutes. Something was going really, really bad. But then eventually, throughout the following couple of years, we kind of got it.
Mm-hmm.
We made it work. And then NVIDIA said, well, now that we know how to do it with Tesla, we really want to do it with other car manufacturers. And back then, self-driving was not really a thing. You didn't have a lot of cameras around the cars to process a lot of data. But NVIDIA saw the potential of self-driving, and they had internal teams doing the early AI of computer vision and self-driving, but they knew that car manufacturers were not ready yet. So they said, well, we want to partner with those companies. We want to establish all the partnerships. We want to have our GPUs in those cars. Then eventually, when the technology is there, we already have all the car partnerships. We have the chips inside. We know how to integrate with cars. We just add more powerful chips, and we just drive more cameras. And we either integrate with existing algorithms by the car manufacturers, we use our own, and that's how we're going to get self-driving. So that was the idea of NVIDIA, which was really prolific.
This is quite a journey, by the way, you know, from Ruse over being at home with a Native American and wolves to, okay, building, you know, the future of autonomous driving, basically.
Yeah, that was pretty amazing. It was really clear for everyone, not only at NVIDIA, but I think a lot of people in Silicon Valley, that Tesla was going to be this company that changes how the car industry goes, kind of like Apple with the phone. But they didn't have enough funding, they didn't have enough traction, no cars out there yet. But the infrastructure and how Tesla was thinking about cars was very different. It wasn't a car manufacturer that wants to integrate a little bit of technology here and there and have this technology improve every year by a little bit. Tesla was building a technological product and it was just wrapping it around a car design, with iterating every week, every month, even to this date. If you buy a Tesla car today, it will be different than a Tesla car in a month, because they will be constantly improving not only software but hardware things around the car, not to wait for a model year, which is kind of the same thinking how software should be done in the cloud. You know, you just constantly iterate, not only fix bugs but improve, give more features, without the user thinking about it, without the user being involved. You just continue innovating nonstop.
How did you develop this strong, you know, observability of how to build strategy? I mean, you're speaking here, so that was your first job from the university, and you already, you know, could understand, okay, this is a strategical decision, this is why to do it, this is how we're going to do it. Did you, at what point did you get involved and you also, you know, develop this business acumen, which is super, super, you know, important?
Well, early on as a junior engineer just starting up, I wasn't thinking about strategy specifically, but then in a few years, as you see how everyone else thinks about technology and where technology is going and how those large corporations like NVIDIA, and I'll talk about Apple eventually, how they think about their vision, not only in the next few years, but in the next 10 years and how to get there.
Mm-hmm.
When you're in that environment for a few years, then you kind of get it. Those corporations, they're not large because they think about technology or product roadmap or their customers, you know, what they will be using in the next year or two.
Mm-hmm.
Where is the world going to be in 10 years and how do we get there? And all the different little steps can be done as a continuous improvement to get us to that level. Because most of the time, technology is not ready. Technology is shitty. We're all going to have, you know, AR lenses in our eyes eventually. But how to get there is not going to be a zero and one kind of a transition. We'll have so many iterations of VR, AR headsets and glasses and whatever it is throughout decades to eventually have this technology, and we're going to think about it and we'll say, wow, how do we live without it? What was an iPhone if we could get something in our eyes? Same idea with self-driving cars, right? My kids, they're 3 and 1. They most likely will not know how to to drive. They wouldn't need to know, and actually it would be dangerous for them to drive.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to prove that self-driving is much safer than you driving manually. Maybe you drive manually for fun on a track or maybe off-road, but in the real world, why would you create so much risk for you and everyone else if you don't have to, right? So kind of like the same way of thinking those large corporations have, how to get to that kind of, you know, in this sense, level 5 self-driving. We'll have to go through all the little levels, 1, 2, 3, 4, to get to level 5, which is, you know, the dream of everyone, you know, having a car with no person inside.
And did you encounter a similar mindset and, you know, eagerness to build a vision for the next 10 years at Apple? Was it similar?
For sure. So, yeah. So Apple is just a machine. If Tesla was a startup with some funding and great vision, and Elon is just an amazing visionary, mm-hmm. Apple has a strategy for the next 50 years. And Apple can afford to build 100 products at the same time and only come out on the market publicly with a few. Many are kind of the same, but with a little different technology and sensors that are not ready yet for mass market because they're not as accurate as what Apple wants them to be.
Mm-hmm.
Other products may never come out, or they'll come out in 5 years or 10 years, right? But the goal is how to get to, you know, in Apple's mindset. How to get to a technological advancement in a way to create a new product category, right? A new product category requires so much innovation. So in nowadays, technology is so complex, so much money. It's becoming harder and harder, and only a very few companies will be able to afford the new things that will come out in the future. Like what you're talking about, for example, you know, AR and VR, you know, we've kind of seen it in the last few years, and you know, Oculus and Facebook are doing things, but for my parents and my grandparents to use AR and VR in their way of thinking, the technology needs to be many decades away from here. It needs to be completely transparent, completely easy, and it will take hundreds of billions of dollars or a huge investment from multiple companies to get it there.
Mm-hmm.
So Apple is thinking in that sense, how to create different technologies. Maybe in the next few years they'll be applied into products, actual products that that we can see, that we can use in our world, like Face ID. You know, Face ID is what? Face ID, and it's dear to my heart because I was a little bit involved in the project, and you know, my company Alcatraz is doing, you know, facial authentication based products. Face ID is really about knowing the face, tracking the face very privately, very securely. You know, the user owns the data, but owning and tracking the face, always recognizing what, not only who the person is, but the facial expression of the person, you know, doing eye tracking, gazing, and so on. So that's really going to be useful eventually when you go into VR for a company like Apple to actually not only know what's going on outside in the physical environment, but also sensing your face and your facial expressions in a way to put yourself into a VR environment very accurately with real time, you know, like real time representing your face as well.
Mm.
Like a bunch of cameras on the face, kind of 3D modeling your face and animating it, you know, in VR. But that technology, to get there, it needs to go through all the little first steps, and the Face ID is just one of those first steps.
What always struck me by with Apple is that the way that they actually designed the products was so intuitive, so that almost everyone very fast could adopt the usage of it. Even for elderly generations, it was much easier actually to use a smartphone with a touch screen than the old ones where we had the buttons. I saw that so many times. It's like, okay, they start playing with it, and then at some point they kind of, you know, get confident that I can use it. In this sense, I read in an interview also about you that the way that you want to design products, you want to create products, you want them to be also pleasurable to use. Did you develop that at Apple?
So Apple's main main purpose in life is to delight customers. Mm. How do you delight a customer you know, with a product that is easy to use, pleasurable to use, it gives you a lot of value? But another way to delight the customer is actually to not need to actually interact with the product. So one such thing again is Face ID. My grandpa, he's 95. He doesn't know he's using Face ID. I'm sure he forgot that we enrolled his face. He doesn't know that there is any facial recognition going on. He's just swiping up. And the experience is so seamless as he's swiping up on his phone. You know, he's just starting to use his phone as just a gesture without any thinking about authentication, right? So the best technology, and you know, probably people have heard about this expression, is the one that's magical, the ones that doesn't require any guide, any knowledge to use, or maybe not, you don't even use it. Mm-hmm. And that's Apple's purpose, how to create something that just works. You know, we've also heard about this kind of an expression by Apple. How to create all different little technologies around wireless communication and chipsets and, you know, industrial design in a way to make it pleasurable, but ideally not there at all. And that's mm-hmm. what we're trying to do with Alcatraz as well.
I was just about to point that out, that actually your technology, the way that it's designed and the way that I also had the chance to experience it in your office, is that I'm not even going to have interaction.
That's the ideal case. Yeah. And as the technology progresses throughout generations, we want to integrate into things that you wouldn't even expect for them to authenticate you. Mm-hmm. Right? We want to make things, you know, smaller and not cheaper, so we can deploy everywhere and, you know, so fast that not only you don't have to interact, you don't even see what's going on. You have no time because you just go. That's the main goal with Alcatraz. You just go, but there's so many things going on as a complex transaction that actually we create a very secure, very high-end experience, not only for the users, but actually for the security admins who are our, you know, buyers, our decision makers that we provide value to, you know, increasing security while decreasing friction. Ideally, there is no friction because people don't even realize what's going on. Mm-hmm. Similar to Apple, and as a startup like Alcatraz, it takes just more effort, more time to get to that level of magic. And I'm kind of proud we accomplished that. But
let's get back to the beginnings, actually, of Alcatraz. I think already before that, you had a very stellar career, you know, working for projects like this, you know, being at Apple. I think this is probably the dream of so many people around the world. And then you still decide to go on an entrepreneurial journey to start your own company, to build your own product. I think you also started already from the beginning as a single founder. Lead me through this decision-making process. Why, in the first place? Why you already had a wonderful, probably, career and a wonderful life, very comfortable one. Why go into the trouble of doing a startup?
Actually, quite a bit of trouble. I guess that's true. It wasn't easy to be kind of starting up as a almost single founder. We had some early on engineers. Mm-hmm. The decision making process was kind of easy. There is this period in someone's life where they can afford to be freer and do things as they like in complete freedom. Mm-hmm. That's before family and kids, before the financial responsibility that is kind of connected to this, a period where you can take risks. Yeah. Maybe a couple periods. Maybe those couple periods are, before family and then eventually after some of the kids are raised, but you also have financial stability to keep supporting them and continue starting a new journey, because that's creating the actual risk. So in my case, I could just see that if I don't take this opportunity now, because we were on the cusp of having the face as the main credential for the phone, for mobile, but in the physical world, we saw the opportunity that nothing like that exists. Mm-hmm. And we thought we knew how to make it. Actually, we didn't. It took us way more money and time to create something to be very robust for enterprise, much more complex than what we thought it would be on the phone, because on the phone, it's not easy, but there are less requirements, because you see like one face, one person, you can control the conditions. Well, in the physical world, the enterprise, it's much more complex to have so many people in different velocities, different environments to go through, but you have to create the same kind of magic. We just saw the opportunity to go now. Otherwise, in a few years, other companies may start doing that. The technologies were finally available, not only to Apple, and Apple was a pioneer in facial mm-hmm. authentication, and they still are. If you think about other companies, how they do facial authentication, it's not as good. It's not as secure. It's not as private. Even 5 years after Apple announced Face ID, there is still no company that can actually do that as good as 5 years ago that Apple is doing it, not what their Apple is doing now on the latest generations of Face ID.
Wow, okay.
And it took Apple a long time, many years and many acquisitions to create Face ID. So we just saw the opportunity, and it was just the right time for myself personally to take the risk, because I knew maybe another opportunity will be eventually in many years. And, it's just... the stars need to align.
Did you count with this time to market that you had with Alcatraz? Because I think, starting a hardware company, in addition to that, starting something which is going to be adopted by enterprises, it takes a lot of time to build. Did you know that when you started?
No kidding. Yeah, we didn't know anything. We had consumer mindsets. We thought we would make a nice hardware product, put it on people's walls, and it would just work, and everyone's going to want to buy it. It wasn't the case. We didn't know anything about the security industry, the buyer, the sales cycles, all the requirements that are outside what we thought we need to design as a minimum viable product in the actual hardware. Our actual hardware, we call the ROC, and the machine learning computer vision algorithms in it, is a very, very small thing of what we do.
Why did you call it the ROC, by the way?
Our company is called Alcatraz.
Yes.
The ex-prison, now an island, mm-hmm. kind of museum. Its nickname is called the ROC. Mm-hmm. Alcatraz is known as the ROC. Maybe someone has seen the Sean Connery movie back in the days. So we decided, we are from the Bay Area. We're creating something very secure. We call the company Alcatraz, and the product itself is also something that should be strong. That should create this sense of stiffness. And rock was a natural thing to call the product. So we didn't know anything about the industry. We didn't know that outside creating a product that can do kind of facial recognition, facial authentication, 90% of that is actually outside the product. All that our platform does in the cloud. Eventually, we found out that although the world is moving to the cloud, Fortune 1000 companies and government don't trust the cloud yet. Mm-hmm. So we had to virtualize the cloud to an on-premise solution, air-gapped, which means Alcatraz doesn't have access to any data. We can't even know what's going on in the field. If there is a bug, if something doesn't work, we have to fly. We have to go physically to the location to find out what's going on. That means there is no feedback cycle of how to improve the product, because we don't. As soon as we deploy, we don't know what's going on. We cannot collect any data. The data we need is actually something that we cannot buy online. We have to create it ourselves. And We did a lot of data collection here in Bulgaria through actors. We hired actors to act out different scenarios of tailgating, for example, because you can't just Google tailgating data and, you just buy data. It doesn't exist, especially in our case. We use 3D and infrared and color sensors, cameras to hybridly merge the data for us to increase the accuracy and the experience and the reporting of our product. So it was very hard to go and deploy into large enterprise and government, just because we spent years and years after developing the hardware product to actually being able to deploy and then legally be deployed and convert customers through all the certifications and networking, privacy, security requirements that those large organizations need. And in Europe, a few years ago, GDPR became the standard of how you deal with privacy and data. But in the US, which is our go-to-market country, there is no GDPR. It started as a hearsay or what could be created as a regulation, maybe federal level, state level. As you know, each state is kind of like its own country, and usually the regulation starts kind of state level first, and eventually it may take years or decades. It will go federal level. So we had to create kind of like an umbrella software and hardware that can convert and can be legally deployed, with all the privacy and security implications of the corporations. Not how they're thinking about privacy and security today, but how everyone will be thinking about privacy and security in 10 years, because our product actually needs to work on like deployed for 10 years plus in those enterprises.
Well, yes.
Through software updates, hardware deployments. How would the regulation in one state will look like in comparison to another state? We have to take the common denominator and create something that will be easily manageable or flexible in a way to always comply with whatever is going to come out in the future on-premise air-gapped.
I just remember when we adopted the GDPR the regulation in Europe, a lot of the people, they knew the text, they knew how it sounds, but no one knew how it's going to be applied. We were all waiting for those first, victims or, those who are going to get some kind of penalty to understand of how the regulator actually is going, meant it in a practical level. Did you have the same issue in the States? Because, I mean, you obviously talk to the regulators, but how is this going to apply? This is going to be, these are going to be the judges, I guess.
Not only in the US, we were having the same kind of similar challenges in Europe, even though GDPR has been here for a while. Each country interprets it in a slightly different way.
Yeah.
For example, how do you deal with data of employees when they come, but also when they go from the company?
Mm-hmm.
Do you store it for 30 days, 60 days, 90 days? What kind of data? What if there is a legal issue between the employee and the company and there is a case open? Do you keep the data for how long? For how long after the legal issue is done? Who has access to it? Where is the data stored? Each country has a little bit of a different regulation. And it's a little challenging when you have to work with a large corporation. A Fortune 10 corporation
yes.
that has offices in many European countries, but also in Asian countries and US countries. In each country, we'll have different rules about biometrics, about personal data. Even though Alcatraz has a lot of features, has a lot of infrastructure in a way to not deal with any personal data. We don't have to store pictures. We don't have to know employee names. We don't have to know anything about anyone. Only a batch number is needed for us to store and output. That's it. Even this may be considered in a way some kind of a data that we know, and we have to deal with us handling it differently for each country, even though it's under the same corporation. But also being able to sync up everything real time, and one employee goes to another country, a third country, a fourth country, and they can still use, you know, their face magically everywhere. And it just works, right? Instead of them having 20 different badges to badge in everywhere. So a lot of challenges to solve around GDPR and, you know, in different other countries, like in US, even state level, the regulations around privacy.
So you had actually a lot of challenges along the way. And I wonder, you know, some coming from the consumer industry and being very optimistic about how you're going to launch your own company and create a product, you had to face certain disillusionment at some point. What helped you remain sane and still motivated and, you know, continue forward? Do you have a good tip for that? Because this is something which I really admire about your path so far.
Good question. Sane, I would say barely sane. very, very barely. It's a very thin line. I really wish I had a co-founder or even co-founders, which is usually how you should start such a complex business. I didn't know it would be so complex. I always dreamt about a brother and a sister. I never had such, and I always dreamt about, you know, having people to be side by side with me when we have to make difficult decisions, when we are receiving difficult answers by customers, by investors, by any means, trying to solve things together instead of everything going through me. Many tough moments. It's just you just keep learning and keep going. It's okay to cry a little bit. You just wake up in the morning and maybe you have not one but two cups of coffee, and then you continue. And you know, in those early days in a startup's life, you have no time to take a vacation, even a day or two, to reset. So you just keep going, and you try to find motivation or joy in the little things in life, which is stayed with me to try to appreciate the smallest things in life, which otherwise, you know, prior to Alcatraz, I kind of took for granted. Things like, you know, spending time with the people I love for even 5 minutes, with my phone down, you know, being right there, or just walking my dogs, you know, in the evening is something of a meditational experience for me. So you just keep going and look for those moments, and you gotta suck it up.
Tell me about the fundraising for a startup that provides hardware as a service. I can imagine it's a bit different. And actually, you mentioned when we met at some point that one of the critical moments in the development of Alcatraz was the time when investor dropped out at the last minute and put everything in a financial stress.
A few times, actually.
A few times. Tell me about your fundraising journey.
So fundraising journey, to get funding for hardware or hardware as a service, actually for hardware is almost impossible. You can get to a Kickstarter maybe. Hardware as a service in a B2B kind of a business, very tough. Out of 100 VCs, all the tier ones and two VCs, I would say 90% will give you a gentle, nice excuse that they want to wait for traction or whatever the reason is. But actually, it's just very risky, especially if you're creating hardware that's complex, that requires something that they like. It requires software and hardware and infrastructure and different certifications. Usually the VCs will not go deep to understand what's going on, and they'll need some proof points that this business model is going to work. Especially through COVID, you have supply chain issues and components, logistical issues, inventory issues. You have to, you know, make the product to eventually sell it. You have to deploy the product, you have to maintain the product. Depending on the industry, there are issues in how you're deploying and connecting to the infrastructure. You need a lot more money to create something like hardware, drones and, self-driving cars, if it's, a hardware module or, robots, or in our case, our product is basically a robot without arms. That's that's how, those are the sensors and the chipsets that we're using inside. So the VC will see so many risks in execution and deployment and business model and traction that they will just not want to touch it. On top of it, they will go back and look at statistics. How many hardware or hardware as a service companies had successful exits, went to IPO? Not an exit of, 50 million, 100 million, but actually went to a unicorn status and beyond, right? There are actually none. Only a few companies, maybe like GoPro or Fitbit, didn't exit. But actually, they're not doing well, right? Fitbit was acquired by Google mostly for the data, not because Google, Google could, and they have sensors and they have technology that can create those bands. Mm-hmm. GoPro, you can buy 1,000 different kind of vendors out of China that does, they do exactly the same kind of a sports action camera product. So not a lot of successful stories, or almost no successful stories. For VCs, it's just super high risk, a lot of money, a lot of different teams that need to work on a product in a way that's distributed but also very tightly connected to eventually have the product functioning and to be able to be sold. So all of those risks are just making it impossible for VCs to understand and then get the buy-in to invest in a company. And I'm saying only 10% of the VCs would invest. Actually, 10% of the VCs will be open to hear a pitch, the story of a company, like really hear. I'm not talking about going on a Zoom call and looking at the slides and eventually having a couple questions. Only 10% of the VCs will be open to hear and maybe dive a little deeper, maybe as a second meeting, to learn more about the company in a way to make an actual decision based on facts of development and traction and investment and the industry, really connected to your specific company. Very, very few.
I guess this is also a tough lesson because, they would give you, as you said, a gentle excuse of how they would go into investing later. And then at some point you realize this is not how it is going to be.
As a founder, I spend a lot of time fundraising. I basically been fundraising since the beginning.
That would have been my next question. How many VCs did you pitch to?
Depending on the rounds, right? Like early on, you cannot really pitch to VCs. You may pitch to little VCs, micro VCs, or VCs that have smaller funds and angels or super angels. Mm. So our first funding actually was led. It was a pre-seed angel round. It was led by an angel out of Silicon Valley that my lawyers introduced me to. So wow. The angel had an angel group. Then they led the round, and then a couple of micro or mini VCs also added some investment to have our little round going for me to be able to get a few people in the company from Apple and a few other places for us to start real development of the prototype that we wanted to show off to eventually get some more investment. So that was the early on, and then as you progress, right, you start pitching. You kind of started learning who to pitch to. I think I've talked to so many VCs that I shouldn't have wasted my time on, because I should have known through not only getting more background information, but having my gut feeling, even initially, even if I meet them for the first time, that they are not the right fit as a mindset, as a fund, as a thesis on what they're investing in. Mm-hmm. So I think that would be my advice. And I advise now other companies to really do their due diligence on their ideal investor profile and very rarely deviate from it, because it's not about the time of you know, how much you spend pitching to the VCs that will never invest in you. They may give you feedback. Many VCs will start giving you feedback even if they don't want to invest in the company, and you will be pulled in all kinds of different directions with different slides and business models, especially early on when things are not really locked down, that can kind of make a lot of things chaotic in your pitch and in the company. And it also plays a mind game, right? It matters if you hear a couple no's every week, or if you hear 50 no's every week. You kind of start doubting about, you know, start doubting yourself, start doubting the product, the company, the business model, the industry, life in general. When so many people tell you no, or gentle no, or maybe yes, but maybe in the future when you have traction. Obviously, if you have traction, then, you know, the more traction you have, the easier it is for everyone to invest. Right?
The risk is lower. Yeah, but this is not the idea of venture capital, right? How many people did tell you that this is not going to work?
Hundreds.
Yeah.
More than a couple hundred.
Okay.
Yeah, definitely a lot. I would say I've learned to listen to my gut, even initially when you talk to someone about whether this conversation can go somewhere. It's a lot for me, and I would think on the other side also for the VC, is not only about that you have to meet all the requirements of the fund and the thesis, maybe the personal thesis of that partner that you're talking to in the VC fund, but also there needs to be some kind of personal connection. Because it's not only a one-way decision, it's also the founder decision to let that investment in by that fund. But actually, it's not the fund, it's the partner that will come in your company. It's a little bit of like a marriage.
Yeah.
Especially if you have a round with a lead investor and a few others, very often the lead investor will come and join you on your board as a director, you know, with a vote. Maybe a few others will join as observers. But those guys, you will see them very often. You have some tough conversations, not already easy conversations. They'll help you grow the company through recruiting and advice. They'll help you save the company, as what happened a couple times for us. If times are tough and we need a bridge round so we can continue going and get traction to eventually have enough traction to get to the next stage of our fundraising process. So those are the guys that will be there for you, just like a family member.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a very connected, very close family member, like your immediate family, like a wife and a husband, or maybe as a cousin who kind of you see once in a while, but every time they come, you feel connected with them because they're in this family to win together.
I like the metaphor. I think this is quite often a very different perspective of how we see our investors in the startup community. I remember years ago we saw them a bit as, you know, the gods, and you have to do everything that they say. Then we had the founders market period where the founders were actually had the power. Now this period, I think, is over. We're in a bear market. You still manage to fundraise. By the way, I know at some point you decided to build a team here in Sofia. And I wondered, you spent most of your life in the US.
Mm-hmm.
Where did the connection to Bulgaria come from? I mean, how did you sustain that over the years? Why did you decide to, you know, trust Sofia as a hub for tech development?
Yeah, so first, I've always been connected to Bulgaria. My parents and relatives are here, and I have a few friends as well. I think it happened a little bit by luck because I didn't know that I'll have an opportunity to create a team here. Actually, I was thinking about creating a team somewhere else to help us with engineering back in the days in 2016, 2017, because it was just hard to extract people from those large corporations because their salary was many times over what we could afford at Alcatraz. Plus, the retention in the US, especially in Silicon Valley, is really tough. People just jump companies every year, every couple of years, and that can kill a startup. A startup you have one of in a team initially, and then maybe two of in a team. And in our case, we had many teams and one of each. If one leaves, you have no team, and things can just stop. So you have to really pick who you're hiring to kind of know if, that they will train. They'll get they'll need some time to really get involved and impact the company technologically early on, but then you have to trust them they're going to stay. And I remember I just came for Christmas here, one of my first Christmases back in the days in Bulgaria. And I met a few of my friends, and they introduced me to a few people that were just starting up some ideas and some funds early on, because back in the days there were only a couple of funds that were professionally investing into startups. No incubators, no co-working spaces, nothing.
Which year was that? Do you remember?
That was 2016
2016,
when they
okay.
came. There were some ideas and in early steps, but nothing like what we had, in the last couple of years. But that was it for me. I thought it would be great to do things here in Bulgaria, and I saw the potential that there will be some startup infrastructure that will be built. And also there was this company, like an engineering company, an engineering services company that could help us from Bulgaria to build some of the software on our chipsets to do demos on our product. And I decided, wow, actually, let me get an office right across the street from that company, hire a few people so they can collaborate across the street. It will be easier for us. And that's how the whole thing started.
Well, nice.
Yeah, now we have 35, 40 people in Sofia. The product, there is no way we could have any product without the team here. Almost all of our software is built in Bulgaria. We're a hardware as a service company, but actually 90% of everything is software that we develop. The secret sauce is software. Anyone can buy our product and disassemble and put together
Make a
the
copycat.
components. That doesn't matter. It's all about software.
So now you have a more direct experience with the Bulgarian tech talent. How would you say are we different from what you have seen already in the Silicon Valley?
It depends on the person, if they have experience working with large corporations, if they have experience working in large corporations, in different time zones, in companies that have offices 10 hours apart, like what we have. We have an office in Indianapolis, we have an office in Cupertino, that's 7 and 10 hours apart from here. I would say retention is amazing. We basically have no people leaving the company in the last all years, in the last 4 or 5 years, which I'm mind blown because I know actually retention in Bulgaria by itself is great, but it's not that good.
Which speaks also for your culture, by the way.
I mean, yeah, I think it's culture and product. A lot of the teammates that we're getting, they're referrals, they may be friends of friends, so people kind of know each other. I'm so amazed, and I'm so happy that I was able to stay this summer for a while with my family and spend time with everyone here. People stay in the evening until 10 p.m. having Lukanka and, you know, drinking Rakia in the office, which is a very different culture and a mindset from you know, in the US.
Nice.
So that's what I love. A lot of collaboration. Even through COVID, we thought initially, you know, virtual environments will make things less efficient. Actually not. Like we missed, you know, people seeing each other, but actually, you know, through a little bit more process, we were able to get things right. Mm. So this is the good thing. You know, there are always negatives around virtual teams or teams that are separate from one another and time differences. And, you know, we have a lot more steps to accomplish to make things more efficient with processes and structure. Mm. But overall, that was one of the best decisions that I made for Alcatraz.
Can I ask you about another rather untypical decision in your story? You decided to step down from the role of the CEO. You passed the baton to Tina, a very seasoned, you know, executive. Maybe not necessarily coming from the startup scene. Was it difficult to make this decision? Was it difficult to go through that transition? And do you feel now that you found someone who is more like a co-founder, someone who is, I don't know how to put it, you mentioned before, like a sister?
Yeah, great question. The whole thing happened very organically. You know, it usually when someone steps down and someone replaces the CEO, maybe the board required that, maybe there is something in the background that doesn't work. For me, it was a very easy decision, and actually it happened through time. You know, one of the largest corporations in security invested in us. Mm. And through that, I got to know Tina because she was the general manager there in California. I was kind of mind blown on how she's thinking about the industry and the depth of experience she has. So first I asked her to be an advisor for the company, kind of giving mm-hmm. us ideas on go-to-market and business model and how to gain traction kind of for us. We also kind of use her to bounce ideas as if she's the decision maker of our target markets, because it was hard for us early on to talk to the decision maker, because the decision mm-hmm. makers in those large corporations, they don't want to share with us their security issues, their security challenges. Right? It's a situation where things are not publicly available, and I personally didn't have any connections in the security industry to have buddies that are able to share. So Tina was kind of the corridor for us to connect, you know, through other means as well, but also through Tina, our mindset, our way of thinking to the decision maker way of thinking, because she knew the decision maker. She used to work with the decision makers of those large corporations for 20 plus years. Mm-hmm. So she became an advisor. Then I started thinking about, okay, what would it take for us to bring Tina as chief revenue officer? Mm-hmm. So she basically is responsible for sales and marketing, because, you know, in the company back then, we were 90% plus engineers. I still have an engineering kind of mindset and soul. And we needed someone very strong in business and marketing. Someone who can talk to a lot of the sales channel, a lot of the partners we have to create, because we don't sell direct. We can talk to the customer direct, but we will sell through a sales channel, through the middleman, but also be able to talk to the actual end user. Because if you think about it, you know, our decision maker, the buyer, they may be an ex-cop, ex-FBI, ex-CIA agent that is now more senior, and they became the chief security officer or director of security in a large corporation. And if I go, you know, they were like, who is this Russian dude that's trying to sell me high security in my corporation? It doesn't seem right. Plus, it's Alcatraz, new company, unproven technology. It's a lot of risk, and their actual job is to de-risk security, right? And we're actually creating more risk by selling them our product.
But isn't it also a very male-dominated kind of position in a company?
The security industry is a little more legacy with an old school mindset, mm-hmm. but also the right females with the right experience can actually make bigger waves, even stronger changes. Because a lot of the senior execs, the decision makers, they would. They would not be open to listen to many, but for the right ones, mm-hmm. they would click because mm-hmm. that's what they would be missing in their life, mm-hmm. right?
I mean, the topic is so obviously so loaded, so it's even hard to discuss it.
it is what it is. Depending on the industry, there is a different buyer, different mindset.
Exactly.
In our industry, it's a little more legacy. So we had to go through the stages of learning about the buyer, learning how to talk to the buyer, and we're still going through this through sales enablement and, different way of thinking. And now we have an actual real a marketing team to create those stories and messages for all the different buyers we have in our industry.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah. So anyway, I started talking about Tina. We got her as a chief revenue officer. And it was very, very fluid. She started coming to board meetings with me, to pitches with me. Since we became a real great team. I talk about the company and the technology and the engineering side. She talks about the sales and the marketing side. And then it was just organic that I thought it would be an actual path-changing experience for Alcatraz, not only for me, but for Alcatraz. It's better for Alcatraz if she takes over through her industry depth and experience, not only external facing, but also internal facing. Now that we had 50, 60 people in the company, so many different complexities on how people work together, and now that we're building sales and actual teams through non-engineering teams mm-hmm. that will go and get the buyer. And
It also difficult to sell the your decision to your shareholders, to the board?
It took some time. And,
okay.
As I mentioned, investors, partners, they invest not only in the company, but in the founder, right? So it took some time to warm them up to the idea.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel very strongly, very soon, definitely now, they fully agree and they're excited and they trust the decision was right. Because, creating a team in Sofia was one of the best decisions for Alcatraz, and also the other best decision was for Tina to take over and lead our company.
It's an amazing story. By the way, I'm very happy also that you are being involved in the local ecosystem through the Endeavor Network as well. You're now in the role of someone who can mentor, and there is so much that you have gained in experience in order to do that. I hope that many people would actually listen to this story because there is a lot that can be learned. You're at this stage, maybe because it was so difficult in these early stages of Alcatraz, you've learned so much. And in this sense, I wanted to ask you, why is it important for you personally to share your experience with the others, with those who are maybe now at the beginning, who are optimistic? And how do you do that? Aren't you afraid sometimes that you're going to maybe demotivate them?
Yeah, I would say I'm getting to know myself now after so many years of that kind of an experience, which was a kind of like a boot camp of how to do and how not to do things.
Very well put.
With all the different corner cases of what can go wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm getting to know myself that I really love advising companies in a way so they don't make the same mistakes like me. That can be through a business model, or you know, how to pitch, who to pitch, timing, what's required. You know, I've done so many investor meetings that I wish the companies after me, maybe the companies I will create or other people create, every time they go to a pitch, there should be a high degree of certainty the answer will be yes on the other side. And there are a lot of things in a puzzle that need to go right for the VC, for the investor to say yes. And you know, investment is just one small portion of the company's goal. Like, you know, the business model and how to make a company successful is the real problem, the real challenge, what you have to solve for. But the investment will give you the means to do it faster. I just wish I give my knowledge to more companies, more founders, so they have less sleepless nights, less tears. And Endeavor is giving us that chance. That's why I joined Endeavor to help out some of the companies there, especially companies in Bulgaria, to go faster, make less mistakes. And I'm also advising a few companies in the US as well, and help them out with a few of the initial stages, because the initial stages are the most critical with the most unknowns.
You touched on an aspect which I find very important, and unfortunately, we in media create part of the problem that we celebrate deal closings, for instance, as success, where at the end the game is different. I'm not going to ask you if this is right or wrong. I'm actually going to ask you about your idea of success. So you have to project yourself to the moment where you feel like, okay, with Alcatraz, we made it. We are successful. Can you describe this moment for me? Like, where are you? What do you do? How do you know that you've reached the moment where you feel
Yeah,
successful?
so it's an interesting question. As a founder, and now I have another person on the team, like Tina, who I feel like a co-founder. I kind of feel her as a bigger sister, but also you know, as a founder in a way that she cares as deep about Alcatraz, or I feel she cares as deep as about Alcatraz as me, which is kind of weird to say, because you know, Alcatraz is my baby. I created Alcatraz, and you know, as a single parent, you know, I didn't think I can find someone who can adopt the baby in a way to not only adopt on papers, not only adopt to care per a specification of how you care about the baby, but actually care deeply in a way to unfortunately have sleepless nights as many as mine. No, tears as many as mine. So through this, you know, now we're both finding out. I kind of knew it from previous rounds, but even in this round that we closed, well, the round is closed, but actually there is no time to celebrate, because this is not the actual success. You may have this great feeling for a few hours. Okay, I don't have to fundraise for the next X many months or years. But then the actual work, the actual challenge of creating a successful business model to make you profitable, to create real value for your customers, to create value, excitement, motivation for your employees, that's a real challenge. The investment is helping a little bit so you can go longer, because the number one reason for a company to die is just money ends. That's it. And you know, you just have more opportunity, a longer opportunity to go longer to actually solve the real challenge. So not only Alcatraz, any company can call itself a success if first it's profitable, which means you don't need to fundraise anymore. You can do whatever you want. You can reinvest in yourself through the revenue you get, the actual profit you get in a way to grow organically. Right, and then you know the second thing is the actual product needs to be perfect. Yeah, there is no perfection, you know, in real world, but it needs to be close to perfect in a way to hopefully create this magic for the customers. So they, in our case, they don't realize that there is a product. They don't realize that they're doing something. It just works. So when you combine a business that that can sustain by itself and call itself a success, not only because it's profitable and it solved the burn, the revenue issue as a huge challenge, but also delight its customers in a way to create magic. That's a real success.
Wow. So you strive not for perfection, but for a bit less than perfection and magic.
You strive for perfection and then, realizing that you have to come close to it, if possible.
Thank you for sharing this story, for sharing, of the background of your journey, because I think many of us can read an article, can, find out the facts, but it's different when you get the little philosophies and the emotion, and when you share with someone that, we cried back then, we do that together. It gives a totally different flavor to the whole story, and it's very human. So, Venci from Ruse, if I may call you like this, at the end of the conversation, I wish you a lot of magic. At some point of Alcatraz, but also in life. I do believe, and I also feel like you, that we need a bit more magic.
I think we do. I think we do. And thank you for inviting me, Irina. I hope we see each other much more often now.
I hope so too. Definitely. I also, especially from through the Endeavor Network. Thank you.
It was a pleasure.
Next on the Recursive Podcast, serial entrepreneur and investor Elvin Guri.
Being such a flawed individual myself, I have pretty low standards when it comes to the character of the individuals. We look for quality teams. Mm. Outstanding individuals can play and do play a vital role in the founding stage of businesses. However, in our activity, we invest in growth stage businesses where the quality of the organization must become increasingly more important than the quality of the individual that has established or helped create the organization. It is exactly the moment where a firm starts becoming institutionalized, bureaucratized, if you will. That is the point where we would like to start investing, because that's where we can bring more value.
And if you are just as passionate about innovation as we are, hit subscribe for the Recursive Podcast on YouTube or your favorite podcast platform. We're everywhere.